resulted in the establishment of a provisional socialist government under the leadership of Alexander Kerensky. It was relatively moderate in its policies and attempted to accommodate all revolutionary factions, including the Bolsheviks, who were the smallest minority. When the February Revolution occurred, Lenin and Trotsky were not even in Russia. Lenin was in Switzerland and didn't arrive until April. Trotsky was still in New York writing propaganda and giving speeches. The second revolution, called the October Revolution, was the one through which the Bolsheviks came to power. It was, in fact, no revolution at all. It was a coup d'etat. The Bolsheviks simply took advantage of the confusion and indecisiveness that existed among the various groups that comprised the new government and caught them by surprise with a lightning strike of force. With a combination of bribes and propaganda, they recruited several regiments of soldiers and sailors and, in the early morning darkness of October 25th, methodically took military possession of all government buildings and communication centers. No one was prepared for such audacity, and resistance was almost non-existent. By dawn, without the Russian people even knowing what had happened, much less having any voice in that action, their country had been captured by a minority faction and became the world's first so-called People's Republic. Within 2 days, Kerensky had fled for his life, and all provisional government ministers had been arrested. That is how the communists seized Russia, and that is how they held it afterward. Contrary to the Marxian myth, they have never represented the people. They simply have the guns. The basic facts of this so-called revolution are described by Professor Leonard Shapiro in his authoritative work, The Russian Revolutions of 1917. All the evidence suggests that when the crisis came, the great majority of units of the Petrograd garrison did not support the government but simply remained neutral. The Cossack units rejected its call for support, leaving the government with only a few hundred women soldiers and around 2,000 military cadets on its side. The Bolsheviks, on the other hand, could count on several regiments to carry out their orders. Units of the Baltic Fleet also supported them. In the event, the Bolshevik takeover was almost bloodless. In contrast with what had happened in February, nothing could have been less like a city in the throes of revolution than Petrograd on 25 October. Crowds of well-dressed people thronged the streets in the evening, theaters and restaurants were open, and at the opera, Shalyapin sang in Boris Godunov. The principal stations and services had all been taken over by the morning of 25 October without a shot being fired. A battleship and several cruisers, including the Aurora, had reached Petrograd from Kronstadt and were anchored with their guns trained on targets in the city. The provisional government inside the Winter Palace received an ultimatum calling for surrender of its members under threat of bombardment of the palace by Aurora and by the guns of the Peter and Paul fortress. It was only at 9:40 p.m. that the Aurora was ordered to fire and discharged one blank shell. The main effect of this was to accelerate the thinning out of the cadet defenders of the palace, who had already begun to dwindle. The women soldiers, who had formed part of its defense force, also left before the palace was invaded. At 11 p.m., some live shells were fired, and the palace was slightly damaged. The story of the dramatic storming of the Winter Palace, popular with Soviet historians and in the cinema, is a myth. At around 2 a.m. on 26 October, a small detachment of troops, followed by an unruly crowd and led by two members of the MRC, Military Revolutionary Committee, entered the palace. The remaining officer cadets were, apparently, prepared to resist, but were ordered to surrender by the ministers. In the end, the total casualties were three officer cadets wounded. Popular support was not necessary. Eugene Lyons had been a correspondent for United Press in revolutionary Russia. He began his career as highly sympathetic to the Bolsheviks and their new regime, but 6 years of actual living inside the new socialist utopia shattered his illusions. In his acclaimed book, Workers' Paradise Lost, he summarizes the true meaning of the October Revolution. Lenin, Trotsky, and their cohorts did not overthrow the monarchy. They overthrew the first democratic society in Russian history, set up through a truly popular revolution in March 1917. They represented the smallest of the Russian radical movements, but theirs was a movement that scoffed at numbers and frankly mistrusted the multitudes. The workers could be educated for their role after the revolution. They would not be led, but driven to their terrestrial heaven. Lenin always sneered at the obsession of competing socialist groups with their mass base. "Give us an organization of professional revolutionaries," he used to say, "and we will turn Russia upside down." Even these contingents were pathetically duped, having not the remotest notion of the real purposes for which they were being used. They were striking out, they thought, for the multi-party Soviets, for freedom, equality, and other goals which their organizers regarded as emotional garbage. On the brink of the dictatorship, Lenin dared to promise that the state will fade away, since all need of force will vanish. Not at some remote future, but at once. The proletarian state begins to wither immediately after its triumph, for in a classless society a state is unnecessary and impossible. Soviet power is a new kind of state in which there is no bureaucracy, no police, no standing army. Also, so long as the state exists, there is no freedom. When there is freedom, there will be no state. Within a few months after they attained power, most of the Tsarist practices the Leninists had condemned were revived, usually in more ominous forms. Political prisoners, convictions without trial and without the formality of charges, savage persecution of dissenting views, death penalties for more varieties of crime than in any other modern nation. The rest were put into effect in the following years, including the suppression of all other parties, restoration of the internal passport, a state monopoly of the press, along with repressive practices the monarchy had outlived for a century or more. All of this, of course, is a departure from the main narrative, but it has been necessary to illustrate a fact that has been obscured by the passage of time and the acceptance of myth by mainstream historians. The fact is that Lenin and Trotsky were not sent to Russia to overthrow the anti-Semitic Tsar. Their assignment from Wall Street was to overthrow the revolution. Notes from Lincoln Steffens's diary. That this was the prevailing motive of the New York money powers was clearly brought to light in the diary of Lincoln Steffens, one of America's best-known leftist writers of that time. Steffens was on board the SS Kristjanafjord when Trotsky was taken off and arrested in Halifax. He carefully wrote down the conversations he had with other passengers who also were headed to strife-torn Russia. One of these was Charles Crane, vice president of the Crane Company. Crane was a backer of Woodrow Wilson and former chairman of the Democratic Party's Finance Committee. He also had organized the Westinghouse Company in Russia and had made no fewer than 23 prior visits. His son, Richard Crane, was the confidential assistant to then Secretary of State Robert Lansing. It is instructive, therefore, to read Steffens' notes regarding the views of these traveling companions. He wrote, "All agree that the revolution is in its first phase only, that it must grow. Crane and the Russian radicals on the ship think we shall be in Petrograd for the re-revolution." Precisely. Re-revolution was the expectation and the goal, not the elimination of anti-Semitism. With regard to Thompson's claim that he was merely trying to keep Russia in the war against Germany, here again the logic of actual events speak against it. Kerensky and the provisional government were for the war effort. Yet the Red Cross masqueraders eventually threw their strongest support to the Bolsheviks, who were against it. Their excuse was that it was obvious the Bolsheviks would soon control the new government, and they were merely looking to the future. They did not like the Bolsheviks, they said, but had to deal with them pragmatically. So they became staunch supporters merely to gain influence with the inevitable victors and hopefully to persuade them to change their position on the war. Alas, it didn't work out that way. Influence they had, as we have seen, but the Bolsheviks never wavered in their views. After seizing control in the October coup d'etat, they did exactly what they claimed all along they would do. They signed a peace treaty with Germany and confiscated private property. They also began one of the world's greatest bloodbaths to eliminate their opposition. None of this could be blamed on the masqueraders, you understand. It was all the fault of Wilson and the other politicians at home who, by not following Thompson's recommendation to send U.S. tax dollars to the Bolsheviks, forced them into such drastic action. That, at least, is the accepted view. In reality, a Bolshevik victory at that time was anything but certain, and there was little reason, beyond the support given by the New York financiers themselves, to believe they would become the dominant voice of Russia. But even if we grant the assumption that these men were unusually astute political observers who were truly able to foresee the future course, we are still faced with serious obstacles, not the least of which are the thoughts and words of the masqueraders themselves. For example, in February of 1918, Arthur Bullard was in Russia as head of the Russian branch of the Committee on Public Information, which was the war propaganda arm of the U.S. government. Bullard was aptly described by historian George Kennan as a liberal socialist, freelance writer, and private eye of Colonel House. In his official capacity, he had many occasions to consult with Raymond Robbins, and in a report describing one of these conversations, Bullard wrote, "He, Robbins, had one or two reservations, in particular that recognition of the Bolsheviks was long overdue, that it should have been effected immediately, and that had the U.S. so recognized the Bolsheviks, I believe that we would now be in control of the surplus resources of Russia and have control officers at all points on the frontier." Wolves behind the mask. The following year, the U.S. Senate conducted an investigation into the role played by prominent American citizens in supporting the Bolsheviks' rise to power. One of the documents entered into the record was an early communique from Robbins to Bruce Lockhart. In it, Robbins said, "You will hear it said that I am an agent of Wall Street, that I am the servant of William B. Thompson to get Altai copper for him, that I have already got 500,000 acres of the best timberland in Russia for myself, that I have already copped off the Trans-Siberian Railway, that they have given me a monopoly of the platinum in Russia, that this explains my working for the Soviet. You will hear that talk. Now, I do not think it is true, Commissioner, but let us assume it is true. Let us assume that I am here to capture Russia for Wall Street and American businessmen. Let us assume that you are a British wolf and I am an American wolf, and that when this war is over, we are going to eat each other up for the Russian market. Let us do so in perfectly frank man fashion, but let us assume at the same time that we are fairly intelligent wolves, and that we know that if we do not hunt together in this hour, the German wolf will eat us both up." Professor Sutton has placed all this into perspective. In the following passage, he is speaking specifically about William Thompson, but his remarks apply with equal force to Robbins and all of the other financiers who were part of the Red Cross mission in Russia. Thompson's motives were primarily financial and commercial. Specifically, Thompson was interested in the Russian market, and how this market could be influenced, diverted, and captured for post-war exploitation by a Wall Street syndicate or syndicates. Certainly Thompson viewed Germany as an enemy, but less a political enemy than an economic or a commercial enemy. German industry and German banking were the real enemy. To outwit Germany, Thompson was willing to place seed money on any political power vehicle that would achieve his objective. In other words, Thompson was an American imperialist fighting against German imperialism, and this struggle was shrewdly recognized and exploited by Lenin and Trotsky. Thompson was not a Bolshevik, he was not even pro-Bolshevik. Neither was he pro-Kerensky, nor was he even pro-American. The overriding motivation was the capturing of the post-war Russian market, This was a commercial objective. Ideology could sway revolutionary operators like Kerensky, Trotsky, Lenin, et al., but not financiers. Did the wolves of the Round Table actually succeed in their goal? Did they in fact capture the surplus resources of Russia? The answer to that question will not be found in our history books. It must be tracked down along the trail of subsequent events, and what we must look for is this. If the plan had not been successful, we would expect to find a decline of interest on the part of high finance, if not outright hostility. On the other hand, if it did succeed, we would expect to see not only continued support, but some evidence of profit-taking by the investors, a payback for their efforts and their risk. With those footprints as our guide, let us turn now to an overview of what has actually happened since the Bolsheviks were assisted to power by the Round Table Network. Item. After the October Revolution, all the banks in Russia were taken over and nationalized by the Bolsheviks, except one, the Petrograd branch of Rockefeller's National City Bank. Item. Heavy industry in Russia was also nationalized, except the Westinghouse plant, which had been established by Charles Crane, one of the dignitaries aboard the SS Kristianiafjord, who had traveled to Russia with Trotsky to witness the re-revolution. Item. In 1922, the Soviets formed their first international bank. It was not owned and run by the state, as would be dictated by communist theory, but was put together by a syndicate of private bankers. These included not only former Tsarist bankers, but representatives of German, Swedish, and American banks. Most of the foreign capital came from England, including the British government itself. The man appointed as director of the foreign division of the new bank was Max May, vice president of Morgan's Guarantee Trust Company in New York. Item. In the years immediately following the October Revolution, there was a steady stream of large and lucrative, read non-competitive, contracts issued by the Soviets to British and American businesses which were directly or indirectly run by the Round Table Network. The largest of these, for example, was a contract for 50 million pounds of food products to Morris and Company, Chicago meat packers. Edward Morris was married to Helen Swift, whose brother was Harold Swift. Harold Swift had been a major at the Red Cross mission in Russia. Item. In payment for these contracts, and to return the loans of the financiers, the Bolsheviks all but drained their country of its gold, which included the Tsarist government's sizable reserve, and shipped it primarily to American and British banks. In 1920 alone, one shipment came to the U.S. through Stockholm valued at 39 million Swedish kroner. Three shipments came direct, involving 540 boxes of gold valued at 97,200,000 gold rubles, plus at least one other direct shipment, bringing the total to about $20 million. Remember, these are 1920 values. The arrival of these shipments was coordinated by Jacob Schiff's Kuhn Loeb and Company and deposited by Morgan's Guarantee Trust. Item. It was at about this time that the Wilson administration sent 700,000 tons of food to the Soviet Union, which not only saved the regime from certain collapse, but gave Lenin the power to consolidate his control over all of Russia. The U.S. Food Administration, which handled this giant operation, was handsomely profitable for those commercial enterprises that participated. It was headed by Herbert Hoover and directed by Louis Lichtenstein Strauss, married to Alice Hanauer, daughter of one of the partners of Kuhn Loeb and Company. Item. U.S., British, and German wolves soon found a bonanza of profit in selling to the new Soviet regime. Standard Oil and General Electric supplied $37 million worth of machinery from 1921 to 1925, and that was just the beginning. Junkers aircraft in Germany literally created Soviet air power. At least 3 million slave laborers perished in the icy mines of Siberia, digging ore for Britain's Lena Goldfields Limited. W. Averill Harriman, a railroad magnate and banker from the United States who later was to become ambassador to Russia, acquired a 20-year monopoly over all Soviet manganese production. Armand Hammer, close personal friend of Lenin, made one of the world's greatest fortunes by mining Russian asbestos. Additional background: the deaf-mute blind men. In those early years, the Bolsheviks were desperate for foreign goods, services, and capital investment. They knew that they would be gouged by their capitalist associates, but what of it? It wasn't their money. All they cared about was staying in power, and that was not as easy as it may have seemed. Even after the coup d'etat, in which they seized control of the mechanism of government, they still did not control the country at large. In fact, in 1919, Lenin had almost given up hope of expanding beyond Petrograd and a part of Moscow. Except for Odessa, all of southern Russia and the Crimea were in the hands of General Denikin, who was strongly anti-communist. Speaking before the 10th Congress of the Russian Communist Party, Lenin laid it out plainly. "Without the assistance of capital, it will be impossible for us to retain proletarian power in an incredibly ruined country in which the peasantry, also ruined, constitutes the overwhelming majority. And, of course, for this assistance, capital will squeeze hundreds percent out of us. This is what we have to understand. Hence, either this type of economic relations or nothing." On another occasion, Lenin further explained his rationale for accepting Wall Street's terms. He said, "The capitalists of the world and their governments, in pursuit of conquest of the Soviet market, will close their eyes to the indicated higher reality, and thus will turn into deaf-mute blind men. They will extend credits, which will strengthen for us the Communist Party in their countries. And giving us the materials and technology we lack, they will restore our military industry, indispensable for our future victorious attack on our suppliers. In other words, they will labor for the preparation of their own suicide." Arthur Bullard, mentioned previously as the representative in Russia of the U.S. Committee on Public Information, apparently understood the Bolshevik strategy well. Even as early as March of 1918, he sent a cablegram to Washington warning that while it is true we ought to be ready to help any honest government in need, nevertheless, he said, "Men or money sent to the present rulers of Russia will be used against Russians at least as much as against Germans. I strongly advise against giving material help to the present Russian government. Sinister elements in Soviets seem to be gaining control." Unfortunately, Mr. Bullard was a minor player in this game, and his opinion was filtered by others along the way. This cablegram was sent to his superior, none other than Colonel Edward Mandel House, in hopes that it would be relayed to the president. The message did not get through. A side trip through World War II. Returning to the trail of actual events since that time, let us pause briefly to take a short side trip through World War II. Financing and profiting from both sides in a conflict has never been more blatant. Item. From the beginning of Hitler's rise to power, German industry was heavily financed by American and British bankers. Most of the largest U.S. corporations were knowingly invested in war industries. IG Farben was one of the largest of the industrial cartels and was a primary source of political funding for Hitler. It was Farben that staffed and directed Hitler's intelligence section and ran the Nazi slave labor camps as a supplemental source of manpower for Germany's factories. Farben even hired the New York public relations firm of Ivy Lee, who was John D. Rockefeller's PR specialist, to help improve Hitler's public image in America. Lee, incidentally, had also been used to help sell the Soviet regime to the American public in the late 1920s. Item. Much of the capital for the expansion of IG Farben came from Wall Street, primarily Rockefeller's National City Bank, Dillon Reed & Company, also a Rockefeller firm, Morgan's Equitable Trust Company, Harris Forbes & Company, and yes, the predominantly Jewish firm of Kuhn Loeb and Company. Item. During the Allied bombing raids over Germany, the factories and administrative buildings of IG Farben were spared. The U.S. War Department, which determined bombing priorities, was liberally staffed with men who in civilian life had been associates of the investment firms previously mentioned. For example, Under Secretary of War at that time was Robert P. Patterson. James Forrestal was Secretary of the Navy and later became Secretary of Defense. Both men had come from Dillon Reed, and in fact Forrestal had been president of that firm. Item. During World War II, under the Lend-Lease program, the United States sent to the Soviets more than $11 billion in aid, including 14,000 aircraft, nearly 500,000 tanks and other military vehicles, more than 400 combat ships, and even half of the entire U.S. supply of uranium, which then was critically needed for the development of the atomic bomb. But fully one-third of the Lend-Lease shipments during this period comprised industrial equipment and supplies to be used for the development of the Russian economy after the war. And when the war did end, the Lend-Lease program continued to flow into the Soviet Union for over a year. As late as the end of 1946, Russia was still receiving 20-year credit terms at 2 3/8% interest, a far lower rate than returning GIs could obtain. The transfusion mechanism. With the termination of the Lend-Lease program, it was necessary to invent new mechanisms for the support of Soviet Russia and her satellites. One of these was the sale of much-needed commodities at prices below the world market, and in fact below the prices that Americans themselves had to pay for the same items. This meant, of course, as it did in the case of Lend-Lease, that the American taxpayer had to make up the difference. The Soviets were not even required to have the money to buy these goods. American financial institutions, the federal government, and international agencies, which are largely funded by the federal government, such as the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, lent the money to them. Furthermore, the interest rates on these loans also are below the market, requiring still additional subsidy by American citizens. And that is not all. Almost all of these loans have been guaranteed by the United States government, which means that when these countries default in their payments, the gullible American public is once again called upon to make them good. In other words, the new mechanism, innocently and deceptively referred to as trade, is little more than a thinly disguised means by which members of the Round Table, who direct our national policies, have bled billions of dollars from American citizens for an ongoing economic transfusion into the Soviet bloc, and continue to do so now that the word Soviet has been changed to the less offensive democratic socialism. This enables those regimes to enter into contracts with American businessmen to provide essential services. And the circle is complete. From the American taxpayer, to the American government, to the socialist regime, to the American businessman, and ultimately to the American financier who funded the project and provided the political influence to make it all possible. This is the key to understanding the transfusion mechanism. Many Americans have looked at this process and have jumped to the conclusion that there must be a nest of communist agents within our government. In an exam on reality politics, they would receive half credit for that answer. Yes, there undoubtedly have been and continue to be red agents and sympathizers burrowed deep into our government woodwork, and they are all too happy to help the process along. But the main motive force has always come from the non-communist, non-democratic socialist, non-American, non-anything members of the Round Table Network who, as Lenin said, in the pursuit of profit, are laboring for the preparation of their own suicide. These men are incapable of genuine patriotism. They think of themselves not as citizens of any particular country, but as citizens of the world. They can do business just as easily with bloodthirsty dictatorships as with any other government, especially since they are assured by the transfer mechanism that the American taxpayer is going to make good on the deal. When David Rockefeller was asked about the propriety of providing funding for Marxist and communist countries which are openly hostile to the United States, he responded, "I don't think an international bank such as ours ought to try to set itself as a judge about what kind of government a country wishes to have." Wishes to have? He was talking about Angola, where the Marxist dictatorship was forced upon the people with Cuban soldiers and Soviet weapons. Thomas Theobald, vice president of Citicorp, was asked in 1981 about his bank's loans to Poland. Was he embarrassed by making loans to a communist country, especially following the regime's brutal repression of free trade unions? Not at all. "Who knows which political system works?" he replied. "The only test we care about is, can they pay their bills?" What he meant, of course, was, can the American taxpayer pay Poland's bills? Item. The following item, taken directly from the Los Angeles Times, just a few months after Theobald's statement, tells the story. Washington. For months, the Reagan administration has been using federal funds to repay Polish loans owed to U.S. banks, and the bill for this fiscal year may amount to $400 million, Deputy Secretary of Agriculture Richard E. Ling said Monday. They, the Polish authorities, have not been making payments for at least the last half of the last year, Ling said. When they don't make a payment, the U.S. Department of Agriculture makes a payment. Ling said the U.S. government paid $60 million to $70 million a month on guaranteed Polish loans in October, November, December, and January, and "we will continue to pay them." This, remember, was precisely at the time the Polish government had declared martial law and was using military force to crush workers' demonstrations for political reform. The Polish default on this $1.6 billion loan was by no means an isolated event. Communist Romania and a multitude of Latin American countries were soon to follow. The hard fact is that American taxpayers unknowingly have been making monthly bank payments on behalf of communists, socialists, and so-called Third World countries for many years. And with the more recent staging of apparent reform within the former Soviet bloc, Congress has tripped all over itself to greatly accelerate that trend. Americans, of course, want to believe that the evil empire is crumbling, and the Soviets turned Democrats play directly to that desire. Since the end of World War II, their primary objectives have been, 1, to disarm us, and 2, to get our money. The facade of perestroika and glasnost has been merely a ploy to accomplish both objectives at once. All they have had to do is get rid of a few of the old hardliners, replace them with less well-known personalities who are essentially the same. All of the new leaders come from the ranks of the old leadership. Change their labels from communists to social democrats, and then sit back while we happily tear down our military defenses and rush billions of dollars to their failing economies. There undoubtedly will be some progress allowed in the area of free speech, but the military and security organizations continue in full readiness. The iron fist beneath the velvet glove remains ready to strike when the time comes that the facade is no longer necessary. Even if the entire ploy were genuine, there is no reason to believe that these social democracies will ever become better investment risks. The primary thing that has held them back economically in the past is their socialist system, and that most definitely will not be changed. All of the new anti-communist social democrats have pledged their loyalty to the principles of Marx and have said in plain language that they will use our money to develop, not abandon, socialism. These countries will continue to be unproductive and will continue to be unable to pay their loans. The American taxpayers will continue to be forced by the cabal to pay the bill. Item. Before the Bolshevik coup d'etat, Russia was one of the most productive agricultural nations in the world. The great wheat fields in Ukraine justly earned her the title of the breadbasket of Europe. But when the people's utopia arrived, agriculture came to a standstill, and famine stalked the land. Even after Stalin, when the regime is said to have adopted more humane and productive policies, Russia never produced enough food for itself. A nation that cannot feed its citizens cannot develop its industry, and it certainly cannot build a potent military force. It is not surprising, therefore, that for decades the United States has annually sold tens of millions of tons of wheat and other foodstuffs to Russia, emphasizing the underlying transfusion mechanism previously described. Item. The American government industrial complex provided the Soviets with the money, technology, and the actual construction of two of the world's largest and most modern truck plants. The Kama River plant and the Zeal plant produce over 150,000 heavy-duty trucks per year, including armored personnel carriers and missile launchers, plus 250,000 diesel engines, many of which are used to power Soviet tanks. 45% of the cost of this project came from the U.S. Export-Import Bank, an agency of the federal government, and an equal amount from David Rockefeller's Chase Manhattan Bank. The Soviets put up only 10%. The loan, of course, was taxpayer-guaranteed by the U.S. Export-Import Bank, which at the time was under the direction of William Casey. Casey later was appointed as head of the CIA to protect America from global communism. Are you beginning to get the picture? Item. Almost every important facet of Eastern Bloc heavy industry could well be stamped made in the USA. With the specific approval of each successive president, we have provided the latest oil drilling equipment, chemical processing plants, air traffic radar systems, equipment to produce precision bearings, large craft helicopter engines, laser technology, highly advanced computer systems, and nuclear power plants. We have trained hundreds of their technicians in American institutions and factories, and have provided their astronauts with the spacesuits developed by NASA. We have even trained their pilots at U.S. Air Force bases and paid for their military officers to attend our war college. All of this has been used by the Russian government, as Lenin predicted it would, to build their military industry in preparation for an attack on their suppliers. The great pretense of crumbling communism has not altered that strategy. It is the brilliant implementation of it. Item. When Boris Yeltsin seized control of the former Soviet government, one of his first official acts was to decree that foreign businesses had the right to take their profits out of the country. From a purely business perspective, that was a sound move because it would provide incentive for foreign investment. But there was more to it than that. Recall from a previous chapter that the lion's share of that investment was to be funded by American taxpayers in the form of direct aid, bank loan bailouts, and government insurance through the Overseas Private Investment Corporation. Jane Ingraham provides the details. During 1992, Yeltsin wheeled and dealed with Royal Dutch Shell, British Petroleum, Amoco, Texaco, and Exxon. The Chevron joint venture to develop the Tengiz oil field was signed. McDermott International, Marathon Oil, and Mitsui signed a contract with the Russian government to develop oil and natural gas off Sakhalin Island. Chevron and Oman formed a consortium to build a huge pipeline to carry crude oil from Kazakhstan to the Black Sea, Mediterranean, and Persian Gulf. Occidental Petroleum signed a joint venture with Russia to modernize two oil fields in Siberia. Newmont Mining signed a joint venture to extract gold in Uzbekistan. Merrill Lynch's chairman, William Schreier, CFR, signed up as financial advisor to aid in privatizing the Ukrainian State Property Fund. AT&T CEO Robert Allen, CFR, Trilateral Commission, henceforth TC, signed a huge contract to supply switching systems for all of Kazakhstan. U.S. West joined with the Hungarian government to own and operate a national cellular telephone system. GM Vice President Marina Whitman, CFR, TC, joined the governments of Hungary and Yugoslavia to make cars. GE CEO John Welch, CFR, and Vice Chairman of the Board Lawrence Bossidy, TC, bought a majority stake in Hungary's lighting industry. Ralston Purina, Dow Chemical, Eastman Kodak, S.C. Johnson & Son, Xerox, American Express, Procter & Gamble, Woolworth, Philip Morris, Ford, Compaq Computer. Hardly a single American brand name was missing. Item. In February of 1996, the Clinton administration made a $1 billion loan of U.S. taxpayers' money to Russia's state-controlled Aeroflot company so it could more effectively compete with American companies such as Boeing in the building of jumbo jets. By the end of that year, the former Soviet bloc countries had received transfusions from the World Bank of over $3 billion. By mid-2000, it was clear that Russian officials had laundered an additional $7 billion from IMF loans through the Bank of New York. Yet new loans continue to flow. Item. Now the action has spread to China. American banks and businessmen, with taxpayers standing by with guarantees, have provided power-generating equipment, steel mills, and military hardware, including anti-submarine torpedoes and high-tech electronic gear, to update Russian-made jet fighters. All of this is explained as a means of weaning the Red Chinese away from Mother Russia and encouraging them to move closer to free enterprise capitalism. Yet in 1985, at the height of the frenzy over building trade bridges to China, the regime signed a $14 billion trade pact with Russia and, in 1986, sent a $20 million interest-free loan to the communist Sandinistas in Nicaragua. Even after the 1989 Tiananmen Square massacre in Beijing, when U.S. officials were publicly condemning China for human rights violations, business quietly continued as usual. The United States cannot condone the violent attacks and cannot ignore the consequence for our relationship with China, said President Bush. Yet within only a few weeks of the bloodshed, and at the very time that student leaders were being executed, the administration approved a $200 million low-interest loan for delivery of four of Boeing's newest jumbo jet aircraft. In 1993, 47 more jetliners were sold, with a projected sale of 800 more over the next 15 years. Amoco is spending $1.5 billion to develop oil fields in the China Sea. A joint venture between the Chinese government and Chrysler is building military jeeps. A similar joint project is upgrading their F-8 fighter planes. Three communications satellites were cleared for delivery. AT&T contracted a $30 million cellular communications network. China's interest in military technology is revealing. In addition to the advanced hardware purchased from the United States, the Chinese have bought MiG-31 and Su-27 jet fighters from Russia and an aircraft carrier constructed in Ukraine. In May of 1992, China set off its biggest underground nuclear blast. In 1997, the purchase list was extended to include self-propelled gun mortar systems and Russia's most advanced diesel-electric submarines. Although it is known that China maintains a slave labor workforce in excess of 1 million people, they call them convicts, and although the Tariff Act of 1930 prohibits the United States from importing any goods made even in part by convicts or other forced labor, every administration, starting with Nixon, has renewed the most favored nation trade status for China. How is China expected to pay for all this trade? Very simple. By 1996, China had become the largest single recipient of guaranteed loans and subsidies from the World Bank. Item. In addition to these decades of global trade, credit, and taxpayer guarantees, the United States has transferred tens of billions of dollars in direct foreign aid grants, with no pretense at all regarding expectation of repayment. Why is this done? In June of 2000, President Clinton spoke before the Russian parliament and provided the answer. He said, "The United States wants a strong Russia." The next day, he announced that the U.S. would give $78 million to improve the Chernobyl atomic power plant in Kiev. The trail leads to Wall Street, and the tracks are fresh. The Round Table Network did succeed in exploiting the markets of Eastern Europe and continues to do so today. The cast of characters has changed, but the play remains the same. In the beginning, the Council on Foreign Relations was dominated by J.P. Morgan. It is still controlled by international financiers. The Morgan Group gradually has been replaced by the Rockefeller Consortium, and the roll call of participating businesses now reads like the Fortune 500. The operation no longer pretends to be a Red Cross mission. It now masquerades under the cover of East-West Trade. Politicians are fond of talking about the necessity of preserving world peace, and trade, we are told, is one of the best ways to do it. The implication is that this is a time of peace. In truth, we live in one of the most war-torn eras the world has ever seen. No continent today, except Antarctica, is free from war. There are from 25 to 40 military struggles going on somewhere every day of the year. There have been more than 150 armed conflicts since the end of World War II, with the death count already in excess of 20 million and rising. We cannot help noticing that this also has been a period of rising government debt and the global creation of fiat money. The New Alchemy. The alchemists of ancient times vainly sought the philosopher's stone, which they believed would turn lead into gold. Is it possible that such a stone actually has been found? Can it be that the money alchemists of our own time have learned how to transmute war into debt, and debt into war, and both into gold for themselves? In a previous section, we theorized a strategy, dubbed the Rothschild formula, in which the world's money cabal deliberately encourages war as a means of stimulating the profitable production of armaments and of keeping nations perpetually in debt. This is not profit-seeking. It is genocide. It is not a trivial matter, therefore, to inquire into the possibility that our elected and non-elected leaders are, in fact, implementing the Rothschild formula today. Item. In his address to the graduating class at Annapolis in 1983, Secretary of the Navy John Lehman said, "Within weeks, many of you will be looking across just hundreds of feet of water at some of the most modern technology ever invented in America. Unfortunately, it is on Soviet ships." As Professor Sutton observed in his book, The Best Enemy Money Can Buy, the guns, the ammunition, the weapons, and the transportation systems that killed Americans in Korea and Vietnam came from the American-subsidized economy of the Soviet Union. The trucks that carried these weapons down the Ho Chi Minh Trail were manufactured in American-built plants. The ships that carried the supplies to Sihanoukville and Haiphong and later to Angola and Nicaragua, came from NATO allies and used propulsion systems that our State Department could have kept out of Soviet hands. Sutton concludes, "The technical capability to wage the Korean and Vietnamese wars originated on both sides in Western, mainly American, technology, and the political illusion of peaceful trade promoted by the deaf-mute blind men was the carrier for this war-making technology." Item. That leads us to the more recent wars in the Middle East and the rise of Islamic fundamentalism. Iran, Iraq, Syria, Algeria, the PLO, the Muslim Brotherhood, and similar anti-American groupings have all received weapons, funding, and clandestine support from the U.S. government. In the Gulf War, every effort was made to ensure that Hussein's regime was contained, but not destroyed, shades of the Korean and Vietnam Wars. His military infrastructure and most of his weapons were spared. After the ceasefire, he was allowed to keep his fleet of helicopter gunships, which he promptly used to put down a large-scale internal revolt. The big pill to swallow is that for many years Hussein was an asset to the global planners in the West, and they did everything possible to keep him in power. It was only when he refused to allow U.S. companies to dominate Iraqi oil production that he was seriously targeted. Prior to that, he was untouchable, precisely because he was widely perceived as a perfect, despicable enemy. As mentioned previously, the talent pool for the implementation of this strategy has been the Council on Foreign Relations. In 1996, the managing editor of the CFR's journal Foreign Affairs was Farid Zakaria, who offered the following rationalization. Yes, it's tempting to get rid of Saddam, but his bad behavior actually serves America's purposes in the region. If Saddam Hussein did not exist, we would have to invent him. The end of Saddam Hussein would be the end of the anti-Saddam coalition. Nothing destroys an alliance like the disappearance of the enemy. Maintaining a long-term American presence in the Gulf would be difficult in the absence of a regional threat. This is about as clear a statement of the Rothschild formula as one is apt to find. Yet many people cannot believe it is real, even congressmen. For example, Representative James Traficant from Ohio, speaking before the House on April 29, 1997, exclaimed, "America gives billions to Russia. With American cash, Russia builds missiles. Russia then sells those missiles to China, and China, who gets about $45 billion in trade giveaways from Uncle Sam, then sells those Russian-made missiles to Iran. Now Iran, with those Russian-made missiles sold to them by China, threatens the Mideast. So Uncle Sam sends more troops and sends more dollars. Mr. Speaker, this is not foreign policy. This is foreign stupidity." Traficant was on target seeing the problem, but he missed the bullseye with the cause. CFR policymakers are not stupid. They are implementing the Rothschild formula. To justify world government, there must be wars. Wars require enemies with frightful weapons. Iran is one of the best enemies money can buy. Item. The latest act in this play is the buildup of North Korea. Its nuclear capabilities come from China and Russia, both of which receive U.S. trade, investments, and technology. While President Bush was saying that North Korea was part of the Axis of Evil, his administration was sending its so-called humanitarian shipments of food, which the regime used to strengthen its control. We must assume that Western leaders have considered Lenin's prediction that by funding their enemies, they are preparing their own suicide. Ours also, by the way. We must also conclude they are confident of avoiding that fate. Whether they are right or wrong is not the issue here. The point is, they believe they are correct, and they are building a world order which they think they can. How they plan to do that is the subject of a later section, but perpetual war is an important part of it. Fifth reason to abolish the system. There are few historians who would challenge the fact that the funding of World War I, World War II, the Korean War, and the Vietnam War was accomplished by the Mandrake mechanism through the Federal Reserve System. An overview of all wars since the establishment of the Bank of England in 1694 suggests that most of them would have been greatly reduced in severity, or perhaps not even fought at all, without fiat money. It is the ability of governments to acquire money without direct taxation that makes modern warfare possible, and a central bank has become the preferred method of accomplishing that. One can argue the necessity, or at least the inevitability, of fiat money in time of war as a means of raw survival. That is the primal instinct of both individuals and governments, all other considerations aside. We shall leave that for the philosophers. But there can be no debate over the fact that fiat money, in time of peace, has no such justification. Furthermore, the ability of governments and banking institutions to use fiat money to fund the wars of other nations is a powerful temptation for them to become embroiled in those wars for personal profit, political advancement, or other reasons which fall far short of a moral justification for bloodshed. The Federal Reserve System has always served that function. The ongoing strategy of building up the military capabilities of America's potential enemies leaves us no reason to believe we have seen the last of war. Therefore, it is not an exaggeration to say that the Federal Reserve System encourages war. There can be no better reason for the creature to be put to sleep. Summary. The Bolshevik Revolution was a coup d'etat in which a radical minority captured the Russian government from the moderate revolutionary majority. The Red Cross mission of New York financiers threw support to the Bolsheviks and, in return, received economic rewards in the form of rights to Russia's natural resources, plus contracts for construction and supplies. The continued participation in the economic development of Russia and Eastern Europe since that time indicates that this relationship has survived to the present day. These financiers are not pro-communist. Their motivation is profit and power. They are now working to bring both Russia and the United States into a world government which they expect to control. War and threats of war are tools to prod the masses toward the acceptance of that goal. It is essential, therefore, that the United States and the industrialized nations of the world have credible enemies. As these words are being written, Russia is wearing the mask of peace and cooperation. But we have seen that before. We may yet see a return of the evil empire when the timing is right. U.S. government and megabank funding, first of Russian and now of Chinese and Middle East military capabilities, cannot be understood without this insight. Section 4. A Tale of Three Banks. It has been said that those who are ignorant of history are doomed to repeat its mistakes. It may come as a surprise to learn that the Federal Reserve System is America's fourth central bank, not its first. We have been through all this before, and each time the result has been the same. Interested in what happened? Then let's set the coordinates of our time machine to the colony of Massachusetts and the year 1690. Chapter 15. The Lost Treasure Map. The bitter experience of the American colonies with fiat money. The resolve of the Founding Fathers to prohibit the new nation from resorting to paper money without backing. The drafting of the Constitution to that end. The creation of a true American dollar. The prosperity that followed. In the golden days of radio, on the Edgar Bergen show, the ventriloquist would ask his dummy, Mortimer Snerd, "How can you be so stupid?" And the answer was always the same. After a moment of deep thought on the part of Mortimer, he would drawl his reply, "Well, it ain't easy." When we look at the monetary chaos around us today, the evaporating value of the dollar and the collapsing financial institutions, we are compelled to ask, how did we get into this fix? And unfortunately, Mortimer's response would be quite appropriate. To find out how we got to where we are, it will be necessary to know where we started, and a good place to begin that inquiry is with the Constitution of the United States. Article 1, Sections 8 and 10 say, "Congress shall have the power to borrow money, to coin money, regulate the value thereof, and of foreign coin, and fix the standard of weights and measures, and to provide for the punishment of counterfeiting. No state shall coin money, emit bills of credit, or make anything but gold and silver coin a tender in payment of debts." The delegates were precise in their use of these words. Congress was given the power to coin money, not to print it. Thomas M. Cooley's Principles of Constitutional Law explains that to coin money is to stamp pieces of metal for use as a medium of exchange in commerce according to fixed standards of value.